Hello. I'm Lee Liberman-Otis. I am the Senior Vice President and Director of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society, and I'm also one of the people who was involved in starting the organization. We won't discuss quite how long ago that was, and I'm delighted to be here this morning to welcome all of you and also to introduce Secretary Chertoff. I think that I got this assignment because I was involved in the beginning of the Secretary's illustrious career as a presidential appointee. Back when I was in the Council's office under President George Herbert Walker Bush, we had appointed, the President appointed to be U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, a fellow by the name of Samuel Alito, who was not at the time, you know, all that well known, but was at least somewhat known in Republican circles in New Jersey. That appointment was sort of received with some acceptance, but little enthusiasm by the Republicans in the New Jersey congressional delegation, because their idea of who would be a good U.S. attorney was somebody who had paid a lot of attention to them on the rubber chicken circuit. President Bush then, not too long thereafter, there came to be a vacancy on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and President Bush nominated Sam Alito to that vacancy. There was a vigorous discussion about who should succeed Judge Alito in the U.S. attorney position. Judge Alito believed, and the White House Counsel's Office and the Justice Department believed that the right choice for this position unquestionably was Judge Alito's first assistant U.S. attorney, a fellow by the name of Michael Chertoff. But the New Jersey Republican congressional delegation took great umbrage at that because they had a competing candidate who they thought would really be a much better choice. As the previous panel mentioned to some extent, political factors have been known to play a role in these decisions. So there was considerable back and forth with the New Jersey delegation, but ultimately President Bush was successful in persuading them that this was his appointment, and that he was going to nominate Mr. Chertoff. Well, the rest is history. Mr. Chertoff then went on, of course, to succeed Judge Alito on the Third Circuit, and or to follow Judge Alito on the Third Circuit, and then to be the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I have that backwards. Excuse me. And then finally to come forward to accept his current position, which is, I think after the presidency, probably the most challenging job in the United States government. He's done a remarkable job. I'm sure that he will not take credit for the fact that we have not had a terrorist attack on U.S. soil during his tenure. Nonetheless, that is the case, we're all very grateful to him for his work on that, as well as many other matters. In his spare time, he was also the one of the leading spokesman for the president on immigration, where we also had the privilege of collaborating. Please give a warm welcome to Secretary Chertoff.
Well, thank you, Lee, for that great introduction, which reminded me of events also maybe longer ago than I care to remember. I also want to thank Gene Myers, who I had an opportunity to say hello to, and if David McIntosh is here, I want to thank him for his leadership. Lee left out the most important credential I have, which is the husband of the prior speaker. That's, yeah. So you're getting two shirt-offs today. It's great to be back here at the annual convention of the Federalist Society. I wasn't here last year, but I was here. I think I was actually, it may have been in Iraq, but I was here the prior year and spoke. Now, I'm actually not a member of the Federalist Society, not for any particular reason other than I never had occasion to join, but I'm widely reputed to be a member of the Federalist Society. And I kind of use it as a metric on the accuracy of the media, because when they get that wrong, it is symptomatic of the fact they get a lot of things wrong. But I have enjoyed participating in the programs. And when I spoke here 2 years ago, I talked about the issue of international law and how this society ought to get engaged in some of the debate about what international law is and what it should be. I gave this speech. It was a little bit of an off-topic exercise for me, because it's not really part of my domain as Secretary of Homeland Security, although I have bumped into international law issues probably more than I thought I would when I took the job. What was surprising to me was that it actually became one of the most noticed speeches I ever gave. First of all, it caused an enormous outpouring of anger in Europe, because I had the temerity to suggest that maybe we ought to engage in a debate with the Europeans about the proper role of international law and what the content of that ought to be. But also, to my astonishment, on talk radio. I got on a couple of talk radio shows, and people would say, oh, I really liked your speech. And I say, what speech? Immigration, this, that. And they go, no, the one on international law. So it turned out that I feel I had kind of touched a vein, and I thought I'd wade right back into it again in today's speech. And I'm calling this not the rule of lawyers, because I think that's a lot of what is critical in terms of the way international law has developed, and also, frankly, some of the developments in domestic law. What I've been interested to discover, by the way, is that the issue of the appropriate role of lawyers and judges in dealing with a host of issues, particularly those involving national security, is increasingly a topic not only here in the U.S. but overseas. Many of my colleagues, European colleagues, ministers of the interior, who have the responsibility, as I do, to make sure that at the end of the day we are protecting our citizens, many of them have begun to speak out rather bluntly about whether judges are overly intrusive or outside of their skill set in terms of some of the rulings which are increasingly tying the hands of police authorities and law enforcement personnel in Europe. And if you look at some of the rather strong comments made by my counterparts in Europe, you will see they are raising the question of the judge's proper role in dealing particularly with matters of national security, which may not be in their core field of confidence. So I think as we move forward and deal with the emerging issues in national security, both domestically and overseas, the question of the judge's proper role is once again going to come to the fore. And so I'm going to essentially pick up on where I left off 2 years ago and try to talk about how I see this developing, not only in the area of national security here at home in the United States, but also in the international arena. I'm a little surprised to be talking about this for one reason. About 30 years ago, the whole question of what used to be called judicial activism was actually very much a matter of debate in the law schools. And I remember I was a law student, and we were coming in right on the heels of the Warren Court. Many of the members of the court still sat, and there was still a very vigorous discussion about what used to be called judicial restraint and judicial activism. And, of course, to remind you, and particularly for those who were too young to participate in it at that period of time, the debate arose because of the tension between the role of a judge, who's a fallible human being, and has nevertheless the authority to have the last word under our Constitution, and the democratic imperative, which basically views the will of the majority in the voting process as the ultimate touchstone of legitimacy in our system of government. And this question about activism, particularly looking back on the rulings of the Warren Court, really raised the question of how do you properly define a judge's limitations. More recently, I think a better term than judicial restraint was coined by Chief Justice Roberts in his confirmation hearing when he talked about judicial modesty. And the reason I like the term judicial modesty is because it's not about whether you're deciding things in a way that takes affirmative steps or doesn't take affirmative steps. I mean, that depends on what you're deciding. Rather, judicial modesty focuses on a keen appreciation of the institutional and personal limitations of the judge who is given this unique authority to make decisions that are dispositive on a wide range of matters of great public concern. And to recapitulate or remind everybody about the four main arguments in favor of judicial modesty and against what I would call judicial immodesty, I want to remind you what the four main concerns are. The first problem with judicial activism or immodesty is that it really steps outside of what is, to my mind, a fundamental characteristic of lawmaking in the civilized world. That is that law is made openly, transparently, and objectively, and that when the law is published, everybody has an equal opportunity to understand what it is and to know what its scope is. And that's one of the first principles, I think, that was established probably thousands of years ago some of the early great lawmakers. The problem with judicial activism is that it allows, at its worst, private discretion or private interpretations of the law based upon the subjective beliefs and subjective policymaking of the law interpreter. That dramatically changes the law from a transparent, open, and objective process into one that is very idiosyncratic. By the way, this is not uniquely a judicial danger. Legislators, to my surprise, some of them have the same view that what the law is what they personally, privately believed when they were voting for it. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a member of Congress call me up and say, I disagree with your interpretation of the law. I wrote the bill. This is what I meant. And I have to say, I hate to burst your bubble. That's not actually the way judges interpret the law. And it's certainly not the way I'm going to interpret the law, as a kind of a private polling among the people who were then in Congress to see what they now think they passed when they voted on it several years ago. The second problem with judicial activism is the question of separation of powers. When judges step out of the role, at least in the federal system, they are intruding into an area that is out of bounds from the fundamental structure which gives them the legitimacy to have the final word. And so I think part of policing the boundaries of the Constitution means, maybe most important, policing your own boundaries. A third very practical objection to judicial activism has to do with competency. Judges and lawyers are really good at doing certain things, but they're not really good at doing everything. And when they get into the area of moving beyond interpretation of legal text and application of legal judgment and talking about how to improve the legal process, they run the risk of getting into areas where their skill set is really not adequate to the task. Concerns about foreign policy, which are often driven by intelligence that is not, collective intelligence, intelligence that's not accessible to judges, rules about military policy that may require an intimate knowledge of the limitations and the capabilities of the military, again, not accessible to judges, even matters about educational policy or budget, all of these areas become dangerous ground when the people making decisions act too broadly and they attempt to take on the job of making policy decisions that they are not educated or experienced in a way that should be required for those kinds of decisions to be intelligent and competent. And finally, I would say, besides these issues of objective lawmaking, separation of powers, and competency, judicial activism creates a problem because of the issue of legitimacy. Here I'd like to go all the way back to Felix Frankfurter, who I don't know if he's taught that much anymore in law school, but he was taught quite a bit when I was in law school. Chief Justice Rehnquist, Chief Justice Roberts' predecessor and also the judge for whom John Roberts clerked. All of these judges paid a lot of attention to the question of legitimacy. They understood that as much respect as people in our system have for the rule of law, that respect is not simply to be taken for granted. It requires the judges act in a way that is different than lawmakers, because that legitimacy could easily be lost. In another way to put this is that we accept judicial rulings as final and authoritative because we view the judge's role as legitimate, and that legitimacy is drawn from a set of rules and boundaries that the judges themselves impose. And that is the notion of judicial modesty. Now, in the years after I went to law school, it was my impression that actually this debate between people who believed in judicial modesty and people who believed in activism had really been resolved, and that the modesty people basically won. It doesn't mean that everybody agreed or there aren't judges with dramatically different views on individual issues. But my impression when I was a practicing lawyer, and frankly even when I was a judge, was that the differences tended to be methodological, but not really differences about principle. Even judges who might have taken views that, for want of a better word, would be described as more liberal, still felt the need to root their views in reference to some kind of enduring principle. There were very few judges I knew who actually said, I have a right to determine my vision of the good life or to do justice. And while you could have debates about how closely you look at the text, what do you mean by original intent, what is the role of legislative history, and these can be, you know, serious and wide-ranging debates, everybody conceded the basic premise that there had to be some fixed objective set of principles that limit a judge. So I felt in a way that the issue of modesty had been resolved, and that the modesty people won, and that the bounds of debate would become now confined within a much narrower scope. And so it seemed to me that perhaps this was one of these debates that, like the, you know, the scope of the Commerce Clause, or even the idea of the judge's capability to render the final word, that this is a debate that had passed its time and we were going to move on to other things. But I must say that I think now we are entering an era where this debate may come up anew. And it may come up anew both domestically, but even more importantly in the issue of international law, which is where I really want to talk to you. I would say domestically for two reasons. We're probably about to enter a period of time when there will be increased economic regulation, perhaps a degree of economic regulation we haven't experienced since 1980, and we haven't experienced since the days when the role of the judge was being debated. At the same time, we've already seen, because of the new national security challenges that are posed by the struggle against terror, the war against terror, which is a term I will use, and because of the fact that the paradigms between criminal justice and military action have now broken down, we already see judges treading into an area of decision-making that, frankly, for which there's frankly very little precedent, and where judges had not been very deeply involved for the preceding 50 or 100 years. The actual precedent in the area of issues like detention and the scope of the president's power as commander-in-chief, many of those precedents were very sparse before 2001. And so, again, it was an area where judges began to wade in increasingly in an area where there's a lot of fertile ground for creativity, but then, of course, a lot of danger for judicial immodesty. So I believe, first and foremost, that in our own country, we're going to wind up seeing a debate about judicial modesty once again bubble up to the surface. And I think we have to be careful when we wade into that debate to remember that if we believe in judicial modesty, and I personally do believe in that, then it's got to be a principle that we are prepared to be faithful to, whether or not our particular ox is being gored. What will be interesting about the next few years is that there will be people who dislike what the courts do in the area of national security and argue for judicial modesty, but who will then look at economic regulation and be urging the judges to get much more involved in putting forward policy views in preventing certain kinds of economic lawmaking or rulemaking by the incoming Congress and administration. And I think there's a danger in doing that. There's a danger in letting the issue of the role of the judge become subordinated to whether our particular political views win or lose, depending on the outcome of a particular case. Rather, I think we're going to have to impose upon ourselves the discipline, if we are going to argue for judicial modesty, to recognize that sometimes that means we are going to be arguing against case outcomes that we might personally prefer to see, because it might restrain a regulation we disagree with or a law we disagree with. But we're going to have to recognize that if we're not prepared to be faithful to that principle, we will lose the ability to articulate the principle in other areas with credibility and sincerity. But what I'd really like to look at is the issue of the debate abroad, internationally, because that's, I think, an area where judicial modesty never has taken hold. And as international law becomes a bigger and bigger part of the landscape, the need to engage in this debate will become more and more urgent. Let me just give you a few really remarkable stories from the headlines. In Thailand, the current and former government officials, almost the entire cabinet of a former prime minister, the prime minister who succeeded a former prime minister, and a host of other political leaders have all been indicted or removed by the Supreme Court of Thailand. The International Crisis Group described what is going on, and it's a Belgian-based research group, described that what the court in Thailand is doing is essentially undermining all elected governments for minor failings. Essentially, the court is now deciding who is going to be the elected leadership of Thailand. In Turkey, earlier this year, the existing majority government survived an effort by the court to remove it and make it illegitimate as a political party simply by one vote. They didn't quite get the majority they needed to ban the ruling party in Turkey and make it an illegal political party going forward. And the particular issue there was the argument that the prosecutors were making that the majority party, by allowing headscarves in government buildings for observant Muslims, was violating the separation of church and state enshrined in the Constitution there. Now, I don't want to get into criticizing the law of individual countries, but I do want to say that when you read headlines about judges banning political parties and saying that majority political leaders are unfit or unable to hold office, it does raise the question whether the role of the judge as seen overseas is quite the role of modesty that we generally see here at home. Or to put it a different way, are we replacing the rule of law with the rule of lawyers, which some lawyers might like, but which I think would be a very bad thing. Even in Israel, the Jerusalem Post recently observed that there is a repeated tendency on the part of prosecutors who are independent of the ruling political party, an increasing tendency of prosecutors to take very, very broad laws governing campaign finance and apply them creatively so that you have literally almost four of the five last prime ministers under criminal investigation or proceeding or actually indicted. Now, you know, maybe you want to argue that all the prime ministers are corrupt one after the other, but it underscores the danger, as the Jerusalem Post said, of laws that are so broadly defined that they are an invitation to prosecutorial and judicial creativity, which again starts to move you from the rule of law to the rule of lawyers. Of course, most interesting and most absurd, perhaps, there's an investigative magistrate in Spain named Baltasar Garzon, who's done some very good counterterrorist work, but has also sought to file charges against Silvio Berlusconi, Henry Kissinger, and recently opened an investigation of the Franco era murders going back to the 1930s. And I was scratching my head and trying to figure, was he going to try to bring Franco back from the grave and try him? In the last couple of days, he finally stepped back and closed that up. But what this boils down to is the fact that we are dealing with an international legal philosophy that is increasingly viewing the rule of law not as something that disciplines judges and lawyers, but rather an invitation for judges and lawyers to use their precious power to adjudicate and resolve disputes as a way of intruding into the widest range of policymaking, whether it's belief about separation of church and state from a political standpoint, whether it's a national security issue, whether it's simply disagreeing with the individual policies of a particular government. Now, what are the implications of this for the United States? Well, increasingly we operate in a world where we have global travel, global trade, and a global need to fight terrorism by exchanging information and working together. And that means we are increasingly coming into the domain where international law and international and transnational courts will have an impact on the efficacy of what we're trying to do. For a long time, and this is what I said 2 years ago, we have treated this problem as one that is best addressed by simply getting off the stage. So when the International Criminal Court was formed, the United States not only withdrew from participation and failed to ratify it or didn't ratify it, but we actually took steps pursuant to a congressional mandate to make sure that when we put troops in a country, that country did not subject them to the jurisdiction of that court. When the International Court of Justice repeatedly intruded into our country's criminal justice system to argue that we should overturn our procedural rules and stop executions that violated international law, our Supreme Court said, no, thank you. We're going to obey our Constitution. We're not going to subordinate our constitutional role to the international courts. But while this strategy deals with individual challenges, if we are going to be engaged in an international and global way with matters in national security, how do we regulate and prevent terrorists from traveling, with matters of exchange of criminal and terrorist information, and even now perhaps increasingly with matters of financial regulation, we're not going to have the ability to simply withdraw from the international arena because we are uncomfortable with very, very activist and immodest international courts. And so I come back again to suggesting what I suggested 2 years ago, but with greater urgency, because I think the trend has actually intensified over the last 2 years. We are going to have to engage with international law. But I think the way we have to engage is we have to start to engage with the intellectual underpinnings of the kind of activism that has given rise to some of the decisions that I've talked about. Groups like This Society were very successful over a period of years in vigorously challenging the prevailing view of judicial activism, engaging the debate, educating people about why the rule of law is fundamentally based upon a sense of modesty on the part of judges. And for reasons that I've said, I think that this debate was largely won because of your vigorous advocacy and the vigorous advocacy of others who are like-minded. I don't believe we've done that overseas. And I think the withdraw and retreat model will not serve us well. I can tell you, in conclusion, that as I have talked to my colleagues, not just lawyers, but government ministers and political leaders in parliaments and in legislatures in Europe, they are increasingly intrigued by and interested in this debate. They are increasingly concerned about what is the right role of the judiciary and lawyers. And I think there will be fertile ground for a vigorous, intelligent, and honest debate about these issues. So I close by asking you, because I know you'll be obviously preoccupied with legal developments here at home, not to forget the importance of getting overseas, networking with people who are interested in these issues overseas. I will tell you, if you go to Eastern Europe, you will find people who have a very, very keen appreciation for liberty and a very keen appreciation for democracy. And I will tell you, I believe they will be a very fertile field in which this kind of intellectual argument can be planted and can be nourished. Now, obviously, there'll be others who disagree, and that's good. We want to have a debate. But for that debate to take place and for it to be effectively represented, organizations like this must get into the game. And therefore, my urging again, as I urged 2 years ago, but with both greater optimism about your chances of success and greater concern about the need for you to get about doing this, is to get across the ocean and begin the process of talking about the rule of law, not the rule of lawyers, with your counterparts all around the world. Thank you very much.